Brock, do you think how you look in this fight will have any bearing at all on your drawing power in pro wrestling?
I really don't give a shit.
Okay. Now, when it comes
to... I'm a white boy and I'm Jack. Deal with it.
Give it to me, baby.
The beast, the beast.
Give it to me, baby.
The beast, the beast.
Give it to me, baby.
The beast, the beast.
And all the girlies say I'm pretty fly for
white boy.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Happy 4th of July weekend. This is episode 448 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 3rd, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody's having a great weekend, getting ready to barbecue and do whatever it is that you normally do on July 4th. I am looking forward to just having a day off from work. That's the real reason why I look forward to July 4th, but to each their own. Before we get started here, I just want to mention I was really sorry to hear that Elie Wiesel died this weekend. He was one of the last remaining Holocaust survivors. He was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. He went through just unspeakable horrors during the Holocaust, and he saw many members of his own family killed. I remember reading his book, Night, when I was in school. A lot of you tweeted at me and said that you also read the book in high school, and it's definitely a popular book, I think, to have students read, and I think it's absolutely worth people going out of their way to find a copy of that book if they've never had the chance to read it. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what country you're from, race, creed, color. I think it's a book that everybody should read, as awful as the subject matter is. I had the chance to meet the man 2 years ago. It was at an award ceremony that I was promoting, and he was the main honoree. And I'll never forget, you know, I don't think I've ever told this before. So I see him for the first time, and I go over to introduce myself, and he chastised me. He yelled at, well, he didn't yell at me, but basically I guess I mispronounced his last name the first time we met. I think I may have pronounced it like Wiesel, and he said, no, it's Wiesel. But after that, we were good. At first, I thought he was joking, but he wasn't. But after that, we were good, and you know, to have the chance to meet him and to have the conversation that we had, it was brief. It was only a couple of minutes, but that's something I won't forget. So I was very sorry to hear of his passing. I want to give a shout out to all of you guys who have been supporting this podcast. Of course, we've had a sale going on our t-shirts, which is still ongoing, by the way, as I record this. PayPal donations, Audible, you guys have been coming through and supporting the show in a whole host of different ways, so I just want to say thank you, kind of a blanket thank you to everybody. Audible is still offering a 30-day trial of their service to members of this podcast. If you use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster, then go through the sign-up process. You get to sample the service for 30 days, you won't get billed, and you get one free audio book that you get to cash in on. It's kind of like your version of Money in the Bank. You pick what book you want and when within those 30 days, and you can cash in at any time. Doesn't even have to be a wrestling book. And if you should end your trial, if you come to the end of your trial and you do not want to extend for whatever reason, you get to keep that book. It belongs to you. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. That's our link. Spread it around. And that is certainly a good way to support the show and to support Audible, because I think they've got a great service, and I think you'll like it. Also, don't forget our Pro Wrestling Tees sale is still ongoing on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. You can get Sound Off shirts. Of course, wrestling soup shirts are also on sale. Don Tony and Kevin Castle, a lot of good shows to support. This sale goes through Tuesday, so the day after the 4th of July. I guess after the 4th comes the 5th. July 5th, I believe the cutoff time is, I believe it's 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 o'clock Central. So you have until about midday on Tuesday when you go in the store. You could buy one shirt. You could buy as many shirts as you'd like. At checkout, you must put the coupon code America into the box. If you don't do that, you won't get the discount. So the code is America, not Merca, as some of you have asked. You can get yourself 20% off all sound-off gear. And a lot of you have taken advantage of it. There's a lot of people running around, or who, once they're delivered, who will be running around in sound-off shirts. I hope to see many of you, by the way, represented at our meetup, the day of SummerSlam in Brooklyn at the KBH, which is also, the invite is up on our Facebook page. If you haven't already RSVP'd, we are having a meetup Sunday, August 21st at 2 p.m. It's at a German beer hall, beer garden, beer hall. I guess it would be a beer hall. Called the KBH, which is only a couple of blocks away, two, three blocks away from the Barclay Center. We are partnering with Mania Crawl on the event, and I am very much looking forward to seeing all of you there. And if you're in your sound-off gear, that would be great. So definitely sign up if you think you might be able to make it. The event, I mean, look, the event is still, you know, a little under 2 months away. You have time to kind of figure out what you're going to do. Whether you're going to the pay-per-view or not, if you are in the area, if you can make it, I would definitely like to see you there. If you like what you hear each week, you can make a PayPal donation. You can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button to click on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Of course, the offer still stands, $30 or more if you want not just a shout-out, but a quick plug for your business, your blog, your website, Twitter. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, The Chosen Son Andre Smith, The Marietta Mauler Alexandru Mata, John Pipelayer Pog, The California Kid Gabriel Solis, Your Girlfriend's Crush Gary Smith, Justin the JG Man Goodman, Adnan the Jackal Mujtaba, The Hillside Strangler Anthony Itor, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Josh Moneymaker Mussolino, The Blackburn Bruiser, Amir Shah, Alfie the Axe Ward, and Clean Living, Chris Ludek, who runs Prime 8 Essentials, which offers the best in clean living supplements. You can follow them right now on Instagram, at Prime 8 Essentials. That's Prime, the number 8, and the word Essentials. Thank you to everybody who made a donation this week. UFC 200 is this Saturday night, 6 days away. It is a big card. They've got Johnny Bones Jones against Daniel Cormier, Miesha Tate defending her women's title. A lot of big fights, but the biggest perhaps of all, at least to wrestling fans, is Brock Lesnar making his return to the octagon for the first time in about 5 or 6 years. He is stepping into the cage against Mark Hunt. And since the next podcast I record is not going to be until the day after UFC 200, I figured, why not give my prediction now, since I'm sure everybody is suddenly going to become an MMA expert over the next week. So, having not seen Brock Lesnar fight in 5 or 6 years, you know, it's hard to say how he's going to look in there. I don't mean just physically. I just mean in terms of you know, as a fighter, in terms of his skills. He's older. He's been removed from it, like I said, for a number of years. He claims that before he was, you know, just befallen by illness, and now he's 100% and he feels like himself. So it's impossible to say what Brock Lesnar is going to look like in the cage. Anybody who tells you they know, unless you've been training and sparring with him, they don't. It's all just guesswork. So it's hard to make a prediction, you know, a real legit prediction without knowing that. But I have seen videos of what Mark Hunt can do, and it's not pretty. This guy is not a pushover. He's not, you know, just a warm body to put in there so Brock can look good. Quite the opposite. I think Brock is going into this fight. I haven't looked at the betting odds this weekend, but last I checked, I think Brock was going in as the underdog, as he should. And I love Brock, but I'm going to say that Mark Hunt wins by knockout in the first minute of the fight. So that's my prediction. I'm putting exactly $0 on that prediction, by the way, as should you. But that's my prediction. And it also means, by the way, the fact that UFC 200 is next weekend, it also means that if WWE is going to promote this thing at all, it's got to happen this week. And by all accounts, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. On that same media call that you heard a little bit of audio there at the beginning of the podcast, somebody brought up Stephanie McMahon's recent comment. She made a comment in an interview. I don't remember who the interview is with. But Stephanie made a comment that WWE is not supporting Brock's fight. We do not support this fight. They wanted to know, the reporter on the media call, what Brock thought about that. And his response was, "I don't care what she says." That was Brock's response. Here's my question. Why the hell would she even say something like that? Why even stir up that hornet's nest? Stephanie also claimed that UFC is not competition to WWE. And to that I say, if they really believe that, and I'm not sure they do, but if they really do believe that, then why not promote the damn fight? If they're not competition to you. And one of your top stars, if not the star that you pay the most money to, I'm sure, one of your own guys is fighting in a major sporting event. It's going to probably do 1.5 million buys on pay-per-view next weekend. It's going to be all over ESPN. It's going to be all over the papers. How do you ignore that on your TV show and pretend like it doesn't exist? I mean, I know WWE.com will probably have a story on it, and Joey Styles will be tweeting about it, but it's almost like unless it happens on TV, it doesn't happen. It doesn't exist. How do they ignore this fight? As big of a media attraction as it's going to be, I just think the whole thing is completely preposterous to just ignore it and pretend like it doesn't exist. At least put a freaking graphic up and have the announcers do a quick voiceover. And maybe they will. But judging by Stephanie's comments, doesn't look that way. Jerry Lawler had the domestic violence charges against him dropped this week, of course. See, didn't I tell you? Don't count out the king. This is not the last of the king that we're going to see. I'm not saying he didn't do it. Just because the charges were dropped does not make him an innocent man. But he always gets off. I'd get off too if I was dating women that young. But he always gets off of the charges. You know, he's the Teflon Don. We used to have the Teflon Don here in New York. Right? John Gotti. You know? Okay, well, the king is the Teflon Don. Nothing ever sticks to this guy. And as soon as the charges were dropped, WWE issued a statement that now that this has all been resolved, they have lifted his suspension effective immediately. And according to Ryan Satin over at Pro Wrestling Sheet, Lawler will be back in the booth on SmackDown this week. Which does not necessarily mean no Corey Graves in the draft. Maybe coming in and joining Mauro Ranallo on commentary on SmackDown. See, if they really want to shake things up on that show, even though Lawler is back, I would shake up the announce teams as well. And, you know, if you want the king to still be there, then fine. But, you know, you could always do since they have such a hard-on for these three-man announce boots, and I don't see any reason why Byron Saxton needs to be on two shows, maybe Corey Graves gets the call-up and he joins Mauro and Lawler in the three-man booth. Who knows? Again, I'd hate to lose him from NXT. Maybe he can pull double duty. I mean, look, if Byron Saxton can do Raw and SmackDown, then why the hell can't Corey Graves do SmackDown and NXT? It's not like they tape on the same night. I got to talk about this Jimmy Snuka story. This is just unbelievable. So Jimmy Snuka, of course, was deemed mentally incompetent to stand trial. Of course, we've talked about this before. It's been covered. And this past week, someone was on the WrestleCon website. WrestleCon is the annual convention held in conjunction with WrestleMania weekend. WrestleCon 2017 is coming to Orlando, and they're in the section that has all of the guests listed. And in the section of guests for WrestleCon next year is Superfly Jimmy Snuka. The same man who apparently does not know who the current president is. He did not know when asked what day of the week it is. He didn't know where he was. Brother, I don't know where I am, brother. Richard Nixon, the president, brother. He doesn't know. He doesn't know. But apparently he's well enough to go to WrestleCon, unless his family is literally just going to wheel him out there like a piece of meat. He'll be well enough to go sign his name over and over and over again and take pictures at WrestleCon. Now, it is true that he has not been convicted of a crime, and the whole innocent until proven guilty thing and all that, and you know, maybe he needs to make money. Obviously, he's been going through stomach cancer. I don't know how that's going, or you know, what their insurance situation is. It's very possible that they're strapped for cash, and they're desperate, and they need money. This is not so much on Jimmy Snuka. I would not expect anything less from him. This is more from the WrestleCon people, that they would actually think, hey, you know what? It would be a good idea to put this guy on our roster of invited guests. As much of a lightning rod as this guy has become, and there's a lot of divided opinion on Snuka. Most of it negative, but there is a lot of divided opinion on him. Maybe maybe from their perspective, hey, it's controversial, it'll be good for us. I don't know what was going through their head when they decided to put him on that roster, but it was a stupid move. I would not want to associate myself with someone like this in the middle, because this thing is not over. It's not like they found, well, he's not guilty, well, we don't have enough evidence, and so he got off, and this is all like one and done. This is still very much a fluid, active, ongoing situation. The New York Daily News picked up on the story. They ran a whole article on it. And I could also see why WWE hates all of these events that piggyback off WrestleMania every year. Because in the article, they have a line that reads, and I'm quoting here, "The 73-year-old will appear at events during WrestleMania 33 in Orlando, which kicks off next April." Boy, I'm sure that must thrill WWE to be connected to all this. But the Lehigh Valley Prosecutor's Office, they are very much aware of this, and supposedly they're looking into it. Now, the thing with Snuka is, the way they left it, he is supposed to be reevaluated every 6 months to see if he's now better and able to stand trial, which is ridiculous. I mean, because, if they're trying to convince a judge that this man is mentally incompetent, he's only going to get older, he's only going to get worse. It's not like 6 months from now he's going to be all better. Okay, I'm ready now. I'm ready to stand trial. Of course not. So this was just going to go on. Every 6 months there'd be an evaluation, and it would be delayed again and delayed again and delayed again. But now, the good thing about this, maybe we should be thanking WrestleCon, is that it kind of brings this back into the limelight, and the prosecutor's office sees this, and they think the same thing. They're like, what the fuck is going on here? This guy can make events like this and sign his name and meet and interact with fans? Something's going on here. We're going to look into this. We're going to try to reconvene, and we're going to try to get this guy to stand trial, as well they should. And I'm hoping that at that point, in November, December, whatever the 6 months will be when this guy is supposed to be reevaluated, and who knows, maybe they could bump it up quicker. I hope at that point they can end this charade and put this fucking guy on trial. You know what I mean? Forget the whole guilty, innocent, and prejudge. Just put this fucker on trial. Let a jury decide his fate once and for all. I don't buy into this nonsense that he doesn't know where he is, and he doesn't know this, and he doesn't know that. I mean, there have been stories of him just in the last couple of years being at events, and he's very lucid and very much aware of what's going on. I find it very convenient that all of a sudden all this stuff is dredged up again, and now, oh, brother, I don't know where I am, brother. Give me a break. Put this fucking guy on trial already. I still love what the judge said when she said, all due respect to Mr. Snuka, I'm not trying to offend him or anything, but I don't think he's smart enough to pull this act. I don't think he's smart enough to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. Yeah, let's ignore the 35 years of working that this guy has done. This guy has spent his lifetime as an actor. And apparently, he's not smart enough to pretend that he's demented. He's got dementia and he doesn't know where he is. Apparently, it's too difficult to do that. I thought that was a pretty stupid thing for the judge to say also. But let's just end this act. Just put this guy on trial and let a jury decide. And then he could either move on with his life or he could pay for what he did. Dave Bautista did an interview with Alex Greenfield, who worked in WWE as a writer about a decade ago. Alex Greenfield has a podcast on the MLW Network. It's one of MLW's shows. They have a whole bunch over there. I only listened to part one. Part two was subscribers only. I am not a subscriber, although from what I heard, it was kind of, I don't know, a letdown, but there wasn't anything terribly explosive about part two. I guess he just talked more about John Cena and how he can never be the kind of the kiss-ass that he is. But I don't know that it was said in a derogatory way. I just think he was trying to communicate the message from what I read. That he could not do what John Cena has done. He could not be the company guy that John Cena would be for them, that John Cena has been. He just could never see himself in that role, which might answer the question as we talk about what Bautista said here about why they never put him in that spot in the first place. But some of the key highlights from this here, he talked about what a mistake it was for him to come back as a babyface in 2014, and how he wanted to come back as a heel. Vince McMahon was hell-bent on bringing him in as a babyface, and people are going to want to cheer you and all this other stuff. And they did at the beginning, the first night anyway. he really took, you could listen, hear it in his voice, he really took all of that hate and all of the chants and the Bautista and all that stuff, he took it personally. And that may be another mistake of his. You really, I know it's easy for me, you know, sitting here talking about what this other guy went through to say, oh, you shouldn't take it personally. And who knows, if any one of us were in that situation, and you're in front of these crowds night after night, and you've been away for so long, and now you're back, and they're chanting all of these things at you, and they're just not cooperating, they're not reacting in the way that you expected them to, I guess that could be a mind fuck. You know, maybe it could get to you. But I think that's also a mistake that he made, was allowing himself to kind of feel personally hurt by the fans' reaction to him. Because here's the thing. It wasn't his fault. He didn't do anything wrong. You could have put anybody, short of maybe Stone Cold Steve Austin himself, in that position, coming back, in the Royal Rumble match, going to WrestleMania. You could have put anybody in that position, and the fans would have rejected it. You could have put The Rock in that position at that point. And The Rock had already come back, so part of it, I think, was people may have been a little fatigued by, you know, The Rock at that point, since he had come back. He had already had the two matches against John Cena. Maybe if The Rock had not come back up to that point, this was his first return to WWE in like a decade. Okay, short of something monumental like that, the fans were going to reject it no matter what. They didn't reject it because they hated Batista. They rejected it because they wanted Daniel Bryan. And the company had its nose just buried so far up its own ass with their own plans that Big Dave paid the price for it. As did Rey Mysterio in that Royal Rumble match. What the hell did Rey do to anybody? Nothing. His mistake was he wasn't Daniel Bryan. That's why they booed him. You know, it was Daniel Bryan's time. The people knew that. And the company didn't care until CM Punk said, see ya, and messed up Triple H's plans, because that was going to be Triple H's big match that year at WrestleMania. So Punk left, and he fucked up Triple H's plans. Then they finally did the right thing. Things worked out well. But by that point, for Batista, it was too late. You know, Bautista had already become a thing. You know, there was no stopping it. There was no turning back from it. He said he wanted to come back for SummerSlam a couple of months after he left. He wanted to come back and promote Guardians of the Galaxy, which is why he left. Yeah, if you remember, he did the little, what's that little wave that he did in the ring? He said adios and he left. He left because he had work to do on the movie. And he wanted to come back. He wanted to promote the movie. According to Batista, though, he met with Triple H and Stephanie, and Triple H and Stephanie kind of laughed in his face. They kind of laughed at him. They snickered, and they said, now, we don't even know if this movie is going to be a hit. Let's calm down here, you know? And that sounds kind of like a dickish move on their part. Although, I guess, to be fair, I would be kind of surprised if Triple H or Stephanie even knew what the hell Guardians of the Galaxy was. Look, I'll admit, I didn't even know what Guardians of the Galaxy was. You know, when I grew up, I had the comic books, and I'd go to the store, and I still somewhere have a loose leaf, you know, the loose leaf binder with all the cards and the holograms. I remember going to the store and spending $10 on a hologram card. A moron I was. So I was into the Marvel Universe, and not so much DC, but yeah, I never heard of Guardians of the Galaxy before. You know, I'm sure a lot of people didn't know what Guardians of the Galaxy was. Who knew that it would go on to become as big as it did? One of the biggest superhero movies of all time. Movie ended up doing almost $1 billion worldwide. But still, that sounds like a dick move on their part to kind of laugh in the guy's face and say, well, we don't know if this movie's really gonna go anywhere. Perhaps Triple H and Stephanie mistook it for a WWE film. Maybe that's why they felt that way. And I could totally see Stephanie doing that, too. I mean, after all, we just saw her on TV last week, mocking The Miz for his new movie. They even mock their own stuff. They constantly make fun of their own movies on TV. He was also pissed they broke up The Shield right after Evolution put them over in their feud. He thought they could have ran with them as babyfaces for a while longer. They could have gone with the Shield and the Wyatts, he said, until people were just sick to death of seeing it. And it's hard to disagree with him on that. I mean, they definitely blew that off way too fast. So to that, I say, preach on, Big Dave. Preach on. I don't think you're going to find too many people who disagree with the fact that they blew off the Wyatts and the Shield too quickly. That should have been a WrestleMania match that year. He sounded very upset over all of the opportunities that John Cena got with movie roles and such, and yet I think the issue, it wasn't just that John Cena was getting all of these movie roles and all of these opportunities and nobody else was, and he was kind of the other face of the company, because back when you had the two brands, Cena was on one, Batista was on the other, he sees Cena getting all these opportunities first before anybody else, and he's, you know, he asked the question, why? Why is that? Why can't I have some of that? And he would ask, and he would get shot down, and I think where it really made him upset is he said, okay, you're not going to give me these movie roles, you're not going to give me these opportunities. I think he said the company told him, we don't have anything for you. And that's when he said, I'd like to go have permission to take outside film roles, if that's the case, and kind of try to get them on my own. And he was told, in so many words, he was told, you belong to us. Get dressed and go wrestle. We are not going to allow you to go outside the company to solicit movie roles. I don't know that he was told that in those exact words, but that was kind of the gist, of what he was told. And it's a funny thing, isn't it, when you hear stories like that? It's a funny thing. We dictate what you can and cannot do inside and outside our company, even though you are an independent contractor. It's funny how that works, right? Independent contractor, and you're pretty much our slave. We say what you can and can't do, but you're an independent contractor. What a farce that is. And lastly here, he talked about how depressing it was on his last day. I guess this would have been in 2010. How depressing it was to be escorted out of the building that last night by security. Very few people came up to him and said goodbye. Part of it is they just may not have honestly believed that he was leaving, you know, or they thought, well, he'll be back. He makes too much money. He's a big star. He's going to leave. He's going to realize that he needs us more than we need him. And to his credit, he left. And for 4 years, he didn't look back. He went, and it was hard. He couldn't even find an agent to represent him because he had the stink and the stigma of being a pro wrestler trying to break into Hollywood. It's not an easy thing to do. But to his credit, he worked his ass off and he took a lot of lower level movie roles, and eventually he impressed the right people, and look at him now. I look at Batista and I say to myself, you know, The Rock is the biggest example of a success story of a pro wrestler transitioning into Hollywood, transitioning really into, I guess, almost anything. I mean, you can look at, I guess, an Antonio Inoki or a Jesse Ventura. They got into politics. You could argue that's bigger, but The Rock has got to be at the top of the list as far as the greatest success story of all time in terms of making that transition. And I'm sure, you know, it wasn't easy for him either. It's not like The Rock came out of WWE and he was making A-list movies. You know, for every Fast and Furious movie that makes a freaking gazillion dollars and all these big movies that The Rock does, you know, you had a Tooth Fairy, and you had, you know, you had, you know, The Game Plan, and you had movies like that that weren't as big. But Batista left. He didn't look back. He was very upset. He broke his back, he said, for the company on his way out, which is true, although I could have sworn it was his tailbone. I guess the tailbone would technically be part of your back. But I remember that. It was the last match that he and John Cena had. It was on pay-per-view. I don't know if it was Judgment Day, or by that point they were changing the names of all the show, whatever that May pay-per-view was in 2010. They had a match. It was an I Quit match, I think, and Cena gave him an attitude adjustment off the top of a car that was on the stage. He threw him off the top of the car. He crashed through the stage, and I think he over-rotated and he landed on his ass. He broke his tailbone. So, And by that point, he was already supposed to be gone, but he had agreed to stay on longer to work the extra dates for the company, and that's what happened. He broke his frickin' tailbone for them, and nobody seemed to give a shit on the way out. So you know what? I can understand him being a little upset by that. But you hear all of this, and you would think, God, this guy is so bitter. He sounds so bitter and angry. You know what? On some level, maybe he is bitter. I just think he's being honest. See, I always look at Batista kind of like Bret Hart. These two guys don't give a fuck, and they just kind of speak their mind, and they're not worried about political retribution or anything. And why would somebody like Bret Hart be worried about that anyway? It's not like he's wrestling, and Bret seems perfectly content to never go back. I mean, every now and then they'll pick up the phone and call him, and maybe one day that will stop. You know, if Triple H ever does take over from Vince one day, I'm not so sure that Triple H, for all the negative things that Bret Hart has said about him and Stephanie, I didn't read it yet, but I just, before I started recording here, I saw there was another interview apparently that Bret gave, I think, to Forbes, where he was tearing up Stephanie McMahon and what does she know about wrestling. I mean, it's just, you know, when Bret talks about these people, he goes all in. He just, there's no filter. He doesn't care. And that truly is power. You know, when you don't give a shit, that is power. Because you're not worried about anything. You're not worried about offending anybody. You're not worried about, oh, I have a job I've got to keep. He doesn't care. And Batista is the same way. And Batista still loves wrestling. You listen to him talk about it. He wants to come back. He hasn't closed the door on a WWE return for all the negative stuff he said. And for all the talk about, I went back and I fought with them every day over the creative and I wasn't happy and I wanted to be a heel and they wanted me to be a face. He still, in the interview, says one day he may go back. He says, and if I go back, things are going to be very different, but I'd love to at some point go back. You know, he's kind of like The Rock in that way. He still has a soft spot for wrestling, and I think that's cool. He hasn't gone to Hollywood and left wrestling behind. He doesn't pretend like he never was a wrestler. I look at Batista, and I listen to him in every interview he does, and he just comes off as a genuine, honest, like, this is how I really feel. I'm not bullshitting you. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I'm not sugarcoating it. This is how I feel. You know, but, I mean, he's friends with Triple H. He's a lot more friendly with Triple H than he is Vince. You know, Triple H gave him his big break in Evolution. You know, they're pretty tight. But he won't hesitate to go out there and, you know, talk shit about these people if he thinks that they, you know, deserve to have shit spoken about them. And I like that about Batista. I always have. So I don't look at it, I don't, you know, he's not like a bitter guy or anything like that. You know, when you say bitter, when you say like bitter guy, when I hear that, I think of like these broken down guys with no money who are bitter about their glory days and past success. You know, he's not exactly at Rock level yet, but I think in terms of Hollywood, you know, he's getting there. He's had some pretty good success. I just think he really wanted to make that last run work. That's one of the biggest takeaways from this. You could tell when you listen to him speak, it really bothers him how that run turned out. Because I think he was away for so many years. In his mind, he had these visions of going back, and it was going to be so great, and it was going to be perfect, and it wasn't. And I think if he could go back in time and take that back, he would do it in a heartbeat. And I think that bothers him. Raw this past week was live from Tampa, Florida. Raw Instapoll on Twitter, 1,629 votes, 52% thumbs up, 48% thumbs down. So very much a divided opinion on this show. Real quick, shout out to @BlueBloodLive on Twitter, who sent me a screenshot of a video that was uploaded to WWE's YouTube channel with the following title, which has since been taken down. Quote, "Remember when Cesaro won the first ever Andrew the Giant Memorial Battle Royal?" Well, you learn something new every day. So before I forgot, I wanted to just sneak that in there. Back to Raw. The opening segment was one of the, I guess, highlights of the show, you would say. Seth Rollins came out. The question, of course, was, how, if at all, are they going to address the Roman Reigns suspension here on TV? Are they just going to ignore it for the next 3 weeks? Are they going to be honest about it and address it? Are they going to weave it into a storyline? And to their credit, as they should have, they did acknowledge it. Because to just ignore it, it's kind of like I was talking earlier about ignoring Brock Lesnar, one of your biggest stars, is going into a major sporting event, this big fight next weekend, and watch them just turn around tomorrow night and ignore it. It's stupid. It would have been stupid for them to just ignore the Roman Reigns stuff, not mention his name other than, you know, just mentioning the fact that he's still in the pay-per-view main event. If they took him out of the pay-per-view main event, they still would really need to acknowledge it on TV. And they did. And the way they did it was they had Seth Rollins come out and pretend, well, you know, I've got a live mic, and so I could say whatever I want to, and I'm not supposed to talk about this, you know, as if. So he brings up Roman Reigns, and he says, I'm very disappointed. He has let me down. I'm the one who introduced him as part of the Shield into this company, and he's embarrassed me, and he's embarrassed the company. I will say, as this segment went on, Dean Ambrose came out, and he did, you know, he said everybody makes mistakes, and Roman will be fine. But between Seth and Stephanie, they went out of their way to bury this guy on the show. Probably the only time you will ever see or hear Roman Reigns being buried on WWE television. This was part of his punishment. To come out and to acknowledge it on TV, to talk about how he let people down and he embarrassed them, and it was a way to embarrass him. And I don't mind that at all. I said last week, my opinion is they should keep him in the pay-per-view main event. His suspension is 30 days. It's not 34, 35, or 38. 30 days are up a few days before Battleground. He should stay in the main event, and he should eat the pinfall. He absolutely should not get the title back in his first match back. That would be stupid. But I said they should keep him in the match. But all of this stuff and just this coming out, and, you know, it's embarrassing for him. To me, between the suspension and between what they did here, it's punishment enough. So I didn't have a problem at all with what they did here, but it was very obvious they were going out of their way to basically bury him on TV, and it was surreal because he's the last person. Go back 2 weeks. You would never in a million years think they would ever bury Roman Reigns on television. He's the last person they would ever come out and do this to. And it's just funny how things work out sometimes. But there they were. Stephanie came out. She also had some unflattering comments to say about Roman. I want to just take a moment here to address that there's been reports online that have been attributed, I think, to Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch that Vince McMahon wants to do a Roman Reigns redemption storyline upon his return. And then before I started recording here, somebody tweeted me a graphic. I don't know if it's Photoshopped. I tend to think it's fake. I don't think it's real. But they tweeted me this graphic that apparently is previewing some kind of WWE 24/7 network special that's supposed to air the night after Battleground. The Roman Reigns redemption story. It actually said that in the graphic. I can't believe that that's real as far as they already have a show planned. I don't know if that's legit. But on the rumor that this is what Vince's idea is, and I couldn't find anything on the Torch site, so, you know, it maybe Wade said it on one of his podcasts. If he didn't, I apologize. I don't want to attribute it to him if this didn't come from him. But if this is true, that this is what the plan is, that Vince thinks that this is going to be some kind of great comeback story when Reigns comes back, this is a bad idea. This ain't going to work. It's just not going to work. You know, he's staring. It's amazing to me. Vince McMahon, who has had so much success over the years, he's kind of the last Mohican standing. He's, you know, all these promoters have come and gone, and they've gone out of business, or they've died out, or whatever. And Vince, 30-some-odd years later, is still around. He's got this billion-dollar company, this global empire that he's built that's going to live on long after he's gone. And credit to him, he'll go down, he'll go down as the most successful promoter of all time in terms of pro wrestling. But I look at this guy, and I say to myself, he's staring at a million-dollar heel turn. And he's too blind to see it. He's too blind to see it. I just don't get it. I just don't. You've been handed a gift. This is not an ideal situation to have one of your top guys popped on a wellness violation. It's embarrassing. But you got to turn a negative into a positive. And I look at this and I say to myself, the best thing that you could do here, it doesn't even have to be on like the first night he comes back or anything like that. You can, you know, build to it, because you know when he comes back, he's going to get roasted. He's absolutely going to get roasted by these crowds. Not that he wasn't before, but it's going to be even worse. So harness that, use it to your advantage, and make money off this guy as the arrogant heel that I'm sure he could probably pull off very well. But he just doesn't want to do it. He just has no faith. He has so little faith in Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose or any of the NXT guys to come up and fill that void that would be created on the babyface side by Roman going heel, that he can't even think about the idea. And now he's got two people like that. You know, he never wanted to turn John Cena heel. And John Cena will never turn heel. And I understand why. I see John Cena doing these events with these kids. Just give it up, okay? It's just not going to happen. But now, you know, you have the risk of, well, every time somebody comes along who's this great, you know, white meat baby face, and we have, you know, we just have it in our heads that this is going to be our guy, and he's going to be our big baby face savior, and they're just going to be so stubborn about it that you're going to have a whole army of John Cenas who would probably benefit from turning heel or having an attitude or whatever, and they're just not going to do it because they're so goddamn corporate now. They're just so set in their ways. He is so set in his ways that he can't even entertain the idea of something like that. And it hurts the product when you do that. It hurts the product when you do that. So I just think it's stupid. I just think it's stupid, and if that's his idea, good luck to him, because I just don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to blow up in his face. So AJ Styles comes out. John Cena eventually comes out. So the story they built here is if they can win their respective matches, they're each going to have a match on this show, then they can get into the Battleground main event. They will replace Roman Reigns. And they will get into the Battleground main event, and they will make it a three-way or a four-way or a five-way, but they're going to work those guys into the match, which, ironically enough, would make the match probably twice as good. But I understand, you know, you want to have multiple matches on the card. You don't want to put all your guys just in that one main event, so I get that. So that was the story of the show. You know, it all led to a Rollins-Cena match. It led to a Styles-Ambrose main event. Either of them win, they're in the main event of Battleground. And I'm watching this, and it really hit me when AJ Styles walked out. AJ Styles walks out, and by the way, he got, maybe not massive, but he got tons of cheers. And when he initially pitched the idea, he teased the idea that he would be in the Battleground main event, it would be a three-way, it got yes chants. The people in Tampa, Florida were so excited at the prospect of seeing AJ Styles in that main event at the next pay-per-view. But I see AJ come out, and this whole segment is about burying Roman Reigns and teasing the idea that he might not make it to Battleground. And I'm thinking to myself, man, if Roman had failed that test a month earlier than he did, we would have AJ Styles right now as the WWE World Heavyweight Champion. If he had just failed a few weeks earlier, a month earlier, and was going to be out for 30 days, AJ would be the champion right now. Or at least up until Money in the Bank. Maybe they would have had Ambrose cash in on him. I mean, anything's possible. But he would have gotten the title. That's how close we were to an AJ Styles title run. Sasha Banks and Paige beat Charlotte and Dana Brooke. Sasha tapped out Dana using the bank statement. Dana Brooke, you know, she's been in a few matches now. And even just on the outside, she had that botch. It was Charlotte and Paige a few weeks ago. And she fucked up a very simple spot. It was something with the pin or something. I forgot what it was. She's really not that good. She's really not that good. And I don't know why they called her up unless the plan... The only thing I could think of is why they had to call Dana Brooke up now and not Bayley or Asuka or honestly any number of women on NXT that are at least as good as Dana, if not better. Why the rush? Why the rush to call her up? The only thing I could think of is that the plan was, you know, Emma was already up, back on the main roster. They brought in Dana, and they were going to be together like they were on NXT. And maybe the plan was that Emma would do most of the work on TV, and Dana would just improve. She would get better by learning from Emma, working with Emma, traveling with Emma. Because, you know, Emma, I think at this point it's safe to say Emma's a veteran presence, right, on that women's roster. That's the only thing I could think of. And then that plan went to hell when Emma got hurt, and they didn't know what to do with Dana. We literally just called this girl up a week ago. We can't send her back down now. So what do we do? So I think that has to be what happened here. Because they got her out there wrestling matches and stuff, and it just... You know, she really could have benefited from spending another year at the Performance Center. It's like Carmella. You know, they called up Kaz and Enzo, and it's like, where the hell is Carmella? You know, they work so well together as a trio. Well, the idea is that, you know what, they promoted them to the main roster, and they left her behind because she wasn't ready. she wasn't ready. And by spending more time in NXT, you know, theoretically, she'll get better. So in 6 months or a year or a year and a half or however long it takes, when she is ready to come up, she'll be even better than she is now. Isn't that the whole point of developmental? And Dana Brooke has less experience than Carmella does. But it really, every week I see her now, you know, like, she's got that star-like presence. She comes out and she poses, like, her look is good. I think she could end up, look, I may have even said this a long time ago. Somebody can refresh. I vaguely remember saying something to this effect, probably when she was back on NXT, that she reminds me a lot of Candice Michelle. Candice Michelle came in. She was total eye candy. She looked, you know, she was hot as hell, the big boobs and everything else, but she wasn't a great wrestler. But that's not why they brought her in. That's not why they brought in a lot of those women in the mid-2000s. They didn't bring them in because they're so talented in the ring. They brought them in because whoever it was, Johnny Ace or whatever, had a directive to look through freaking modeling catalogs, and he was literally picking women out like a meat market. That's how things worked back then. And we've come a long way since then, which is good. But this woman comes in, and she was doing the GoDaddy commercials and all that. But as time went on, Candice Michelle became a pretty good wrestler. Not for nothing. She actually became a pretty good wrestler. She improved a great deal. And she did so by being on the main roster, because, you know, I don't remember her leaving TV and going down to OVW or anything like that. So it is possible to be on the main roster and just kind of learn through osmosis and just get better over time, and hopefully the same thing happens with Dana. But Dana reminds me a lot of her. She comes in, she's got this look about her. I don't think they picked her out of a bikini catalog. I know she was like a power lifter or whatever it is, you know, that she does, but they saw something in her, in her look, her body, whatever, and they brought her in. And I think over time, she may get better to the point where she actually turns into a pretty damn good wrestler, but she ain't there right now. And it's kind of painful to watch her out there sometimes. Titus O'Neil beat Rusev by countout and is going to get his U.S. title match on Raw this Monday, the 4th of July, fighting the evil Bulgarian for the United States Championship. JBL said something really stupid at the end of this match here. I know, what a shock. Shocking that he would say something dumb. After Titus won, he said, "This could put him in that championship match he's wanted for so long." I'm like, for so long? You mean like the one he had 8 days earlier? Like that championship match? It's like, how stupid do they think we are? I mean, do they think our memory... I mean, I guess they all think we're Jimmy Snuka, because apparently we can't remember what happened a week ago. Could have sworn he had a championship match on their pay-per-view and got beat clean, no less. But apparently he's got the memory of a goldfish, right? Isn't the memory of a goldfish like they can only remember back like 7 or 8 seconds or something? What a life that must be. Have dinner. 7 seconds later, you forgot that you ate, now you're hungry again. So yeah, apparently we all have the brains of a goldfish, according to WWE, and Titus O'Neil does too. Corporate Kane. Corporate Kane was back. He was talking to Stephanie in the back when Miz and Maryse interrupted. They cracked jokes on the crappy movies they were in, and Kane cited rule G15446 of the WWE rulebook. Yes, one of the writers snuck a G1 mention into a Kane promo the same week that New Japan announced the blocks for this year's G1 tournament. He cited the rule book in pointing out that it had been almost 30 days since Miz had defended his Intercontinental title. I fucking died when he mentioned the 30-day rule. I'm like, that's some comedy right there. That right there is Comedy Kane. That could be his next gimmick. We have Corporate Kane, Demon Kane. I want Comedy Kane, because that was a funny line. Stephanie and Miz, or Stephanie said Miz, would defend his title against a mystery man later in the night, which of course turned out to be Demon Kane. They had a horrifically boring match that ended when Maryse faked an ankle injury and Miz got... I guess Miz didn't know she was doing this. He was actually concerned for her. He left the ring. He got counted out. He carried her to the back. This sucked. This sucked. Michael on Twitter made a great point. He said, instead of doing Kane as the mystery man, why not have Darren Young be the one face Miz with Bob Backlund in his corner and have him win the title. His first match back under the tutelage of Bob Backlund, he wins the Intercontinental title. It's not like Miz has been doing anything with it. And I thought to myself, that's a hell of an idea. You know, or they can... Look, Titus is going to get his match on Raw Monday night, right? You know what they could do? They could have Darren Young come out, and he can save Titus, his former tag team partner. He could save Titus from a beat, because I don't think Titus is winning the title. It is July 4th. I guess anything can happen. They can give him a token run with it, but I don't see that happening. So I figure Rusev wins again, and he probably beats Titus down and beats him down and beats him down, and you could have Darren Young come out, make the save, and maybe that's your next U.S. title match at the pay-per-view. You got Darren Young with Bob Backlund in his corner. Bob Backlund, who once wrestled the evil Iranian, can now give Darren Young some guidance in there against another evil foreigner. And so, you know, that could work. Or you could even build to a match at SummerSlam, maybe between them. Because the idea that you're going to put Darren Young in a championship match, I know on the surface it sounds comical, but I would hope the idea here is to actually do something with him. How many weeks, how many months, how many years has it felt like they've been airing these frickin' vignettes for? I would sure hope it's leading to some kind of a push for this guy. I sure hope so. I saw the newest vignette, by the way. This did not air on Raw, so this must have been... I don't know if it's just from YouTube or if it aired on Superstars, but they had a new Bob Backlund, Darren Young vignette. Bob has now given his finisher, the cross-face chicken wing. He has bestowed his finisher to Darren Young. I say he should put the chicken wing on whoever thought these segments were a good idea. Filming them in a studio like this with a split screen... Put that guy in the chicken wing. Seth Rollins pinned John Cena with a pedigree after the club came out to distract Cena. Second time now Cena's been pinned in recent weeks. Not clean, but you know what? A pin is a pin. I saw a video from one of the Japanese house shows they had. They had over, I guess it was in Tokyo or whatever. And AJ Styles once again pinned John Cena. Club came out. They gave him the magic killer. So again, it wasn't clean, but this is the second pinfall win now that AJ Styles has gotten over John Cena. Normally, on these house shows, they give the big happy ending with Cena doing the attitude adjustment or the STF or whatever. It would have been very easy for them to have him beat AJ, but to their credit, they went to Japan, where AJ and the club still have a profile, right? They all came from Japan, and they gave AJ Styles a win in Japan. I think that's kind of cool. Doesn't matter how it happened, but a win is a win. But this was the best thing on the entire show, Cena Rollins here. Not the best of the matches I've seen them in. They've had better, but this was still very good. Loud dueling chants at the beginning of this match. These people were going nuts when this match started. It felt like a pay-per-view main event. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy, they had a literal squash match here on the show against two dudes. Social Outcast came out, talked about how hard they were, because Enzo and Kaz are S-A-W-F-T soft. And so they came out, I guess, comedy. We're not soft, we're hard. I don't ever need to hear Bo Dallas talking about how hard he is, okay? Please don't ever do that again. Then we had the highlight reel with Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens. And I take back what I said before about Cena and Rollins being the best thing on the entire show. This was the best thing on the entire show. Zayn ran down their entire history together. He talked about how Owens was jealous when he signed with WWE before he did. He told Owens to grow a set, which led to chance of grow a set. Owens then responded. He said, I was always happy for your success when I got to WWE, but Sammy couldn't be happy for my success. And that was so awesome because here's a guy. Kevin Owens is a fucking psycho. His very first night, he attacked Sami Zayn and left him laying. He turned on his best friend and left him laying. And then... he beats Sami Zayn, and he takes his championship. And his character, the Kevin Owens character here on the show, cannot understand why Sami Zayn just wouldn't be happy for me. I love it. I think it's great. I think it's one of those little nuances about the character that is awesome. I think Kevin Owens is one of the best characters. He's one of the best people they have right now. I hope they realize what they have in this guy, and they reward him for it. Because he's awesome. So Sami Zayn said this has to end. There's a very good chance that each of us get drafted to different brands, so I challenge you to one final match at Battleground, and Kevin Owens accepted. They then super kicked Chris Jericho at the same time. Jericho was telling everybody to drink it in, so they kicked him in the face. I thought this was an excellent segment. This was the best thing on the entire show. We had another promo off, that's what I'm calling it, between the New Day and the Wyatt family. Xavier Woods was once again under Bray Wyatt's spell. He looked very concerned by what Bray Wyatt was saying. And the question, I guess, is he legitimately scared, or is this all just an act? I guess we'll have to wait and see. Main event was Dean Ambrose and AJ Styles. Seth Rollins was on commentary. He said he was actually rooting for Dean Ambrose to win because he didn't want AJ winning and making the match at Battleground a three-way with Styles. And that actually made sense. It's very rare that they say things here on commentary that make sense. And all it took was putting somebody on headset who's not part of the normal announce team to actually finally make sense. Seth Rollins, or the club, I should say. Seth Rollins was already out there. The club ran out. John Cena then ran out. He took him out, which distracted AJ Styles. And Dean Ambrose got the win with Dirty Deeds. So tit for tat, Cena and Styles cost each other their matches. So the match at Battleground will remain a triple threat with Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose. And tomorrow night, Raw is July 4th. The last time anything big happened on a July 4th episode of Raw, Shawn Michaels kicked Hulk Hogan in the face and turned heel, if only for 6 weeks. And what a glorious 6 weeks it was. 8 years this guy came back for, and I think it's a crime he only spent 6 weeks of those 8 years as a heel. One of the greatest Raw promos of all time was that segment with Shawn in Montreal. But anyway, they're promoting a champion versus champion match between Dean Ambrose and The Miz. And in the preview, they say, and I quote, "You don't want to miss this." Unless, of course, you watched SmackDown last week, where they did the exact same match. Then you can miss it. But if it happened on SmackDown, well, you know the rest. You don't need me to finish that sentence off. We also have Titus O'Neil and Rusev for the U.S. title, and they're having a 16-man tag team elimination match that they're billing as Team USA versus the world. And they are also promising an appearance by a former SmackDown general manager. So by process of elimination, we've already had Teddy Long. We've had John Laurinaitis. I don't think, you know, Stephanie's on TV every week. Paul Heyman, you know, I don't... Heyman's doing his thing with Brock. I don't see any need for him to be on SmackDown. So that doesn't leave a whole lot of people. Has Booker T. You know, Booker T is with them. I don't know. He's on the Raw pre-show every week. So it's not like he's out of the public eye or anything like that. My money is on Vicky Guerrero as the ex-SmackDown GM that they bring back. Even though it is the 4th of July... And there was once a former Olympic gold medalist who was the general manager of SmackDown. I'm just saying. I love getting people's hopes up. One last thing. I wanted to comment on this. And it is something that Steve Austin said on his Steve Austin Show podcast. Because Austin has been real critical lately of WWE. There's a pattern here. In case you didn't notice, after what I talked about earlier with Batista being critical, and Bret Hart being critical, Steve Austin has also been critical of the product. And he said something on one of his recent shows that I actually agree with, and I think it's something that's missing from the show today. So I pulled up a transcript of his comments. This is off the NoDQ website. I just want to read this part here. "There's just no interwoven storylines which carries throughout the course of a Monday Night Raw, where something, a seed, is planted at the beginning and threaded through the entire show. It's just match after match, segment or in-ring segment, skit, whatever you want to call it, backstage promo." End quote. And I could not agree more. I could not agree more with that. Two of the best angles that I've ever seen on Raw. One actually involved Austin. It was back in 97. I'm sure everybody listening to this remembers it. It's the night that he destroyed Bret Hart with a steel chair. He beat him up and put him in an ambulance, and then he beat him up in the ambulance. It was a great, great angle. And it was a show-long storyline. So that one, I don't remember if that one went from the first segment to the final one. It may have all been in the first hour. I don't remember. But it was still pretty much a show-long storyline. Okay, it opened with a promo. Austin was pissed. He was calling out Brett. They were going to have a street fight, and Brett didn't want to do it, so Austin went to the back, and then you had some segments with him pounding on the door, and Brett's got, you know, all the agents with him in the locker room saying, keep the psycho back. Like, it just, it went on throughout the hour. It went on throughout the show. And now they do the angle, the street fight angle, which was great, and Austin beat him down and beat his wrist and everything, because I think Brett was going to be taking some time off to have knee surgery or wrist surgery or something. And they put Brett on the gurney and they put him in the ambulance. Like I said, Austin's in the ambulance. He beats him up. So now they finally get Brett off to the hospital. And it's not over yet. The angle is not over because now Owen Hart and Davey Boy, they're pissed. And they're vowing revenge. We're going to kill him. We're going to kill Steve Austin. We're going to find him and we're going to kill him. So the angle continued. They want revenge on Stone Cold. And I do remember the final segment of the show. So it did go to the end of the show. The final segment of the show was when Brian Pillman, I think, you know, Owen and Davey Boy had gotten their hands on Austin. He was fighting him off. And Brian Pillman came back. I think he had been gone for a while. He comes out of the crowd. He was wearing those tie-dye pants, and he attacks Austin from behind. This is the big Brian Pillman return. He beats down Steve Austin. And I think this is when, this must have been when Pillman joined the Hart Foundation. It had to be. This stuff was wild. I mean, the stuff they were doing here, this was wild stuff, and it played throughout the entire show. It did not follow the formula. They love their formula. This did not follow the formula. Now, the other angle that I'm reminded of is what they called Triple H's Bad Night. And this was in 2000. That was the night that Triple H wrestled Chris Jericho. He lost the title. Remember that at the beginning of the show? And then the very next segment, they came back from commercial and it was still just chaos and controversy. You have Triple H grabbing Earl Hebner, who was the referee for the match, and him and Shane and Stephanie, they literally drag Earl Hebner out to the ring, and they're pissed, and they want him to reverse the decision. Jericho cheated. It's not fair. You know, Earl Hebner put his hands on Triple H, and this was also very just a wild angle. And in the end, Earl Hebner did reverse his decision. Triple H did get the championship back. And then Triple H fired Earl Hebner in that segment. He laid him out with a pedigree. So then in the next hour, Linda McMahon shows up, and she makes the announcement that Stone Cold Steve Austin is going to be in The Rock's corner at Backlash for the singles match between Rock and Triple H. And you have never seen a crowd react to a verbal announcement. Like, Austin wasn't even there. And I don't think they didn't expect Austin was about to come out or anything like that. All it was Linda McMahon of all people. The most monotone of monotone promos you'll ever see. Announcing that at the pay-per-view in a few weeks, Stone Cold is going to come back. And this place just exploded. You would think the glass shattered and he was on his way out to the ring. I've never heard a crowd react to an announcement like this in my life. And Triple H and Shane and Stephanie, they're all pissed off again. They come back out, and I know Linda slaps Stephanie. Stephanie told Triple H to give Linda the pedigree. Shane hit Triple H because he was about to pedigree his mom. And then they're fighting and they're arguing and Stephanie is slapping both of them. And now The Rock's music hits and the people lose their shit. I mean, the whole thing, it was so well done. And it was this again, this show-long storyline. It didn't just end with the Jericho stuff. This was Triple H's horrible night. He lost and won his title back. And now he finds out that Austin is going to be, you know, in The Rock's corner, and all of this stuff is going on, and it was awesome. It was chaotic, and it was awesome. Now, today, you have the opening promo to make a main event for later in the show, and you'll have a few backstage segments with Stephanie, but there's really no major drawn-out show-long storyline that's exciting or that's different than anything that they normally do. They follow the formula. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with the show these days. You know, I'm gonna jack a line here from Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight. Introduce a little anarchy. Those angles I just mentioned, it felt like total anarchy. There was no control. Everything was just breaking down. Now, you can't do that every single week. But you can do it enough to where the show feels a little more chaotic and out of control. Introduce a little anarchy.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
The Roar of the
NXT, Carmella and Alexa Bliss opened the show, had a pretty long match. Alexa won with the Sparkle Splash, which she's now calling the Twisted Bliss, which I like. I like that. I think it's a cool name. She interrupted a Bayley promo later in the show and said that before Bayley can even think about a rematch with Asuka, she has to go through her. So they already made that match for next week. It's going to be Alexa and Bayley. Shinsuke Nakamura had a sit-down interview talking about the match with Finn Balor coming up in a couple of weeks on NXT. This was a very interesting promo. Now, when Jim Ross went over to Japan to do the Wrestle Kingdom show, I remember him talking about meeting for the first time with Nakamura, and he made some comment to the effect of, he speaks English. He knows English, he speaks English. I don't think he ever said he was fluent in it or anything, but he said, you know, he can actually communicate in English. It's good, and that's a positive for him, you know, and obviously if he ever wants to go to the States and work for WWE. So I had always been of the impression that this guy is pretty good when it comes to speaking English. And this is the first time that we've really had a chance here to listen to Nakamura. I mean, he was in the ring with Balor a few weeks ago and had a few lines, but this was a sit-down style interview. And I'm listening to him, and it's like, oh man, this is painful. He's not really very good at English at all. And I'm listening to this, but then every now and then he'll sneak in like a big word, or he'll sneak in, I mean, he's Nakamura, so the whole time he's making these weird facial expressions, and I'm cracking up. I'm sitting here watching this, and I'm like, what is this guy doing here? You know, does he have, jock itch or something? Why is he making these weird faces? And as the interview goes on, it gets a little bit better, but there's long pauses, and he doesn't, you know, maybe he's thinking about what he wants to say, and believe me, I would much rather have this than give him a piece of paper with some long scripted promo. So this at least felt real, like he's kind of struggling to find the words that he wants to use. But I will say, you know, as I'm watching this, it was painful. It was painful to watch. At the very end, he kind of redeemed it. He smiled into the camera and he said, I'm going to give you something spectacular in this match. And it was like, all right, that was pretty cool. But I'm watching this as it's going along and I'm like, oh man, This is not good. So all this talk, you know, about how he should be on the main roster, and he should be. He absolutely should be. I saw him beat Chris Jericho in Japan, and Jericho got on the mic and put him over after the match and called him a future WWE champion. There is no way that Nakamura will ever be WWE champion so long as Vince McMahon is still running WWE. So if and when he eventually gets to the main roster, that's all well and good, and I look forward to that. But the idea that Vince would make somebody like him the champion is laughable. I think the only hope we have for that is if Triple H ever takes the reins. I know Triple H, clearly he brought him in. He sees the talent and the charisma in this guy. But I could see somebody like Vince looking at Nakamura and going, man, this guy could barely speak a lick of English. I can't do anything with him. So I think if what Jericho said is true, and one day he is to hold that title, it won't be happening anytime soon. As long as the old man is there, it ain't going to happen, because he's not good when it comes to trying to get through an entire promo speaking English. And just look at the promos they have you do on the main roster. You know, look no further than that. That's all you got to see. That's where the long, scripted, drawn-out promos come into play. And I cannot for the life of me ever envision Nakamura going on Raw and cutting a 10 to 15-minute long promo like all the other top guys would, like a Reigns or an Ambrose or a Rollins or a Cena. And I don't see that as being a deal breaker personally. It's not like if that were me running the show, I would find other ways to help get this guy over and have him speak kind of in bits and pieces. I wouldn't have him out there like fucking Hamlet, you know, reading Shakespeare out there. But I'm telling you that they have their formula. What did I just get done talking about during the Raw review? They have their formula. They stick to their formula. And those long promos and those show opening promos are as big a part of that formula as anything. And you tell me, you be honest with me, I don't care if you're the biggest Nakamura fan in the world, you can't tell me that you see him going on Raw and doing that. I can't see it. So things are going to have to change, I think, for a guy like him, unfortunately, to have the chance to be in that top spot. But he's got all the tools. I mean, God, the guy has more charisma than probably that entire NXT roster combined. And if you put him on the main roster tomorrow, he's just a weird guy. But I feel like weird is good. It's different. There's nobody like him on that roster. And I think that's a compliment. Because you don't want an army of... You don't want an army of John Cena's. You don't want an army of Randy Orton's. Nakamura is his own guy. There is nobody on the main roster I could look at right now and say, yeah, he's kind of like Nakamura a little bit. There is nobody. There is not a single person. So he's got that going for him, at least. We had Noah Potjus making his NXT television debut. Actually, I feel like I've seen this guy on the show before. Maybe once before in like a squash match or something. So maybe this wasn't his first appearance, or maybe I'm thinking of a house. You know what? I might be thinking of a house show. Because I think it was this guy, this Noah guy, against one of the other like newer NXT people a few months ago, and I feel like that person got hurt. They suffered like a neck injury maybe or something in that match, because I remember seeing screenshots of the guy being worked on in the ring, and Noah was in there, and maybe that's what I'm thinking of. But anyway. He wrestled Andrade Cien Almas. This fucking guy. He comes out wearing basically a top hat and suspenders. Okay, maybe it's not a top hat. It's one of those hats like Noah wears. Okay, not this Noah, not the one of the ring here. The other Noah, Noah Mark. Anybody who's seen photos of Noah Mark and we're at WrestleMania and all these different places, Noah has this hat that he wears every single time I see him. He looks like he's on an African safari. I'm going to burn that hat one day. I don't know when. I don't know where. I might periscope it. But I will burn that hat one day. But back to this guy. So you got the hat. You've got the suspenders. He came out here looking like a total prelim guy. Just a total prelim guy. And in the ring, he's anything but... prelim. You know, he's a great wrestler. That's why they brought him in. And I've heard all these stories about these great matches under the mask as La Sombra that he had in Mexico and in, I think, New Japan. And I don't see it so far. I see a guy who's a good wrestler. He hasn't blown me away at all yet. But he's got to lose those suspenders. He comes out there, he's looking like a Chippendales dancer. He's got to ditch the suspenders. I'm sorry. He did win, at least. He won with the running knees of death in the corner. Main event was Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa beating the Hype Bros, Zack Ryder and Mojo Rawley. Gargano and Ciampa are on something of a win streak now. They took the microphone after the match and they challenged the Revival to a championship match. This brought out American Alpha, who said they were the ones in line for the next title shot. This, of course, brought out the Revival to insult both of them. William Regal came out. He announced a 2 out of 3 falls match for the tag team titles next week between the Revival and American Alpha, which sounds awesome. The two babyface teams, they shook hands before the Authors of Pain ran out there and they beat them all up. And they once again left Jordan and Gable Lang. Paul Ellering appeared on the ramp. He summoned his monsters. I assume this big promo from Ellering explaining who these guys are is... forthcoming any week now, because if not, this is going to get real old real fast. So they better kind of speed things up here a little bit. So this was not a great show. This was not a great show, but they've got the 2 out of 3 falls match next week. Their first match at TakeOver is... I think that's one of my favorite matches all year so far, was that match that American Alpha and the Revival had on the most recent TakeOver show. So if this one is anything like that one, it'll be great. And then the week after that is the Balor-Nakamura match. So things should pick up here on this show over the next couple of weeks. Plus, the Cruiserweight Classic starts up on July 13th. So some good stuff coming up. I'll be reviewing that here on the podcast as well. I want to talk about TNA very briefly here. And it's actually a positive. I have a bit of praise for TNA. The big story this week is this trailer that's been going around hyping the final match, I hope, the final match in this never-ending Matt Hardy-Jeff Hardy feud. And they're calling it the Final Deletion. Why they're calling it the Final Deletion, I don't know. I'm sure there's a story behind it. But they're calling it the Final Deletion, and it's made up like a movie trailer. They did this. It's like a Michael Bay movie. You see Matt Hardy's gardener makes a cameo here. He's holding a stack of fireworks, and Matt Hardy is still using his horrific English accent or whatever accent it is that he's using there. And Jeff Hardy, there's basically a match between Matt Hardy and Jeff Hardy in, I guess, their old ring. Remember the ring that we saw in that segment a few weeks ago, that horrific segment where Matt Hardy had trouble rolling out under the bottom rope, which is one of the greatest things I've seen all year. I guess it's in that ring. They have a match outdoors at the Hardy Complex, filmed at night. There's fireworks. There's explosions. I thought I saw Matt Hardy holding a rocket launcher at one point, and then he was giving Jeff Hardy either a sidewinder in the ocean, or Jeff was giving him a twist of fate in some body of water. This thing was so ridiculous that my first thought when I was done watching it is, I have to watch Impact. For the first time in I don't know how long, I have made it appointment television. I have a note in case I forget, because I'm not used to watching Impact. I might forget. I have a note to watch at least that match. I'm not going to watch the whole show, but I am going to go out of my way on Tuesday night to watch Matt Hardy wrestle Jeff Hardy in what looks like one of the most ridiculous matches I've ever seen. And I applaud TNA for this, because right now they got a whole lot of nothing going on. It's just, they're a dead brand. TNA is a dead brand. I'm not commenting on the type of wrestling. They have a lot of talented guys on that roster, and the wrestling might be rock solid, but I'm talking as a TV show. As a TV show and a brand, there's no buzz. The buzz died long ago. It's a dead brand, and they're just kind of floating in the water like a dead body in the Hudson. Okay, that's TNA right now. And so you got to try something outside the box. You got to do something to get people's attention. And people have been mocking the Matt Hardy, Jeff Hardy stuff for weeks now. And so what TNA has done here is they have made a conscious decision to just go so far off the rails with this thing and embrace the absurdity of it and just ramp it up by 1,000%. Don't play it safe. Just, you know what? People know this is ridiculous already. If we're going to blow this thing off and finish this feud once and for all, we're going to go out literally with a bang. Because that's all you saw in this trailer. Explosions and pyro and fire. And it blew my mind when I watched this. I said, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I must watch this. So I'm looking forward to it. I want to see how ridiculous they can make this thing. For the first time, I can't even tell you how long, I am looking forward to seeing something on Impact. So, thumbs up. Thumbs up to TNA for that. And if you haven't seen the trailer, it is up on their YouTube channel. It looks like a Michael Bay movie when you watch it, only with horrible dialogue and bad acting. So, in other words, a Michael Bay movie. You can go watch that right now up on their YouTube channel. Lucha Underground this past week. Actually, before we get into Lucha Underground from Wednesday, there's a piece of news here. Sexy Star is apparently done with Lucha Underground. She's apparently done with wrestling. That includes AAA. This is according to a story that ran yesterday on a Spanish language news website called Letra Roja. The Letra Roja news website, which does look legit. I had to translate it from Spanish to English, but her husband is a champion boxer. Guy's name is Johnny Gonzalez. They just got married last year. And she has decided to pursue a career in boxing and leave her wrestling career behind. And they even have a picture of her unmasked with her husband. If you have never seen Sexy Star I saw her unmasked once before. I forgot where. But if you've never seen Sexy Star without the mask and you want to know what she looks like, I think it may surprise you. But you can go ahead, and if you can find the article, there's a big picture of them right there. I know she's got stuff filmed for Lucha Underground through next season, so we're going to be seeing plenty of Sexy Star next year, or whenever the next season starts airing on El Rey. But I guess after that, she will be Sexy Star no more. So we're a week away from the start of Ultima Lucha Dos, which is apparently going to be a 3-week event this year, not 2 weeks, at least according to Dario Cueto on the show. It was either Dario or Matt Stryker. Somebody specifically mentioned that it was a three-week event here on the show. So we opened with King Cuerno against Mil Muertes. This was short. I assume it was short because they're saving the really good stuff for their rematch at Ultima Lucha, but for the time it lasted, it was a fight. Cuerno brought a chair into the ring. There was a ref bump. He whacked Mil Muertes in the head with it, so an unprotected chair shot that he did not sell. And Mil Muertes followed that up by punching Cuerno in the face really, really hard. Mil wedged the chair in the corner. Cuerno moved when Mil went for a spear, so of course he hit the chair instead. He got rolled up for the pin, a rare pinfall loss for Mil Muertes here on this show that will lead to, well, we'll talk about that here in a second. Dario Cueto, who, as always, was just awesome here, he met with Taya and Ibelis in his office. He says there can only be one baddest, and then instead of saying bitch, he hesitates. He can't say the word, so he says woman instead. There can only be one baddest woman in the temple. So he makes a match between them for Ultima Lucha. Katrina walks in, and I love this because there was a little interaction here as Ibelis was leaving and Katrina was walking in. They have a history together. Ibelis is leaving. She looks at Katrina and she goes, "I haven't forgotten about you." And then she walks out. I'm still waiting for a match, by the way. I'm still waiting for that match between them. Katrina tells Dario that Mil Muertes wants a rematch with King Cuerno at Ultima Lucha. Dario laughs at her and says, "You come, you take over my temple, you take over my office. Your man tries to kill my brother, and now you want something from me." And Katrina says, "I want a death match." And Dario says, "You know, I hate you, but you know exactly what to say to excite me." So he grants her the match. And then just like that, poof, she vanishes. So the announcers later on, when they were running down the entire card for Ultima Lucha, in promoting this match, they literally hyped it up as someone is going to die. That is the whole, that's the whole catch for the match. That's the hook. You got to want to watch this death match because someone will literally die. And I was going to say, you know, that's something you would never see in WWE. Except there was that one time that Kane vowed to set himself on fire if he did not beat Steve Austin for the title. So I can't say that WWE has never done something like that before. I mean, if you set yourself on fire, I think the implication is that you're gonna burn yourself to death. They didn't exactly say that, but they did at least that one match many, many, many years ago. They did promote that. Prince Puma took on El Dragon Azteca Jr. This was a lot of fun. I'm not sure why this, you know, wasn't the main event, especially since you had Puma out there and Rey, and they seem to be promoting their match as the main event of Ultima Lucha, but yeah, whatever. Minor quibble. I couldn't even keep up, honestly, with the opening of this match. That's how fast these guys were moving. They were moving just, you know, 5 miles a minute here. Rey Mysterio was in Dragon Azteca's corner, and after Puma hit the 630, he stood there. He stopped to stare at Rey before he went for the pin, which I thought was cool. And, you know, you never know with Rey's knees. You always hear about Rey Mysterio's knees and everything, and he's getting older. He's no spring chicken anymore, but I'm really looking forward to that match. They're billing it as a dream match. You know, we just had John Cena and AJ Styles, and they hyped it up. It's a dream match, 15 years in the making. Well, you know what? This is as close to a dream match as you're going to get in Lucha Underground. You know, Rey Mysterio was kind of the forerunner to this whole style, and all of these guys that came after him. Yeah, they talk about how Rey was a big influence for them, and he's their idol, he's their hero, he was the first. And now you have Rey going up against Puma. And Puma, you know, Ricochet, he's one of the best in the business right now, just in terms of outstanding performers that you watch and your jaw drops and he can do things in the ring that nobody else can. He's that guy. And I know he's not going in there as Ricochet, he's going in there as Prince Puma, so his style is a little bit different, but I think they can go out there and steal the show. So I'm looking forward to that. We had Cage, Tejano, the Mac, and Son of Havoc in the ring with Dario Cueto. Dario says all four men would be entered into what he's calling the Unique Opportunity Tournament at Ultima Lucha, with the winner getting, well, of course, they're going to get a unique opportunity. What else are they going to get? And if I'm these four guys, you know, we've heard Dario kind of say this before, you know, imply that if you win this tournament or you win this match, you're going to get something special in the end and you're going to get a unique opportunity. And if I'm these four guys, I don't know that I trust a guy who, you know, hits the nose candy so much. If you'll notice, when we go back to Dario's office, like when somebody walks in and interrupts him sometimes, he's kind of fumbling around with his nose and stuff. And, you know, a unique opportunity could really mean anything if you think about it. A unique opportunity could be, literally anything. It's like, congratulations, Son of Havoc, you've won a unique opportunity. I need you to transport these 12 condoms filled with a certain white powder across the border for me. Can you do it? So anyway, that's going to be a match, I guess, at Ultima Lucha. Main event was Phoenix and Johnny Mundo. Surprisingly, for the first time ever, we were told these two have never had a singles match here on Lucha Underground before, which surprised me. You would think by now they would have. There was a C4. I like the C4. C4 is a cool move. There was a C4 that was used here like in the first like 2 minutes of the match. And it wasn't from the top rope, I will admit. It was just a standing C4. And I don't even know why it bothered me so much, because we see so many moves and super kicks and everything that should be finishes but aren't. But I saw, I think it was Mundo who used the standing C4, and he got a near fall out of it in the first 2 minutes of the match. And I'm like, how have we gotten to the point where a C4... is used for a near fall? It's just like, come on, man. So Mundo got the win after Taya put the trios title, because Mundo was 1/3 of the trios champs. She put the belt in the ring, and Mundo used a belt shot on Phoenix to get the pin. I can't remember the last time I saw that. PJ Black and Jack Evans, his partners, come down, and they start beating the hell out of Phoenix. Drago and Aerostar come out. Ivelisse comes out to go after Taya. They clean house as the announcers hype up Ultima Lucha. The start of it is next week. The Cruiserweight Classic timing is perfect, because once Lucha Underground ends in a few weeks, I guess 3 weeks, I can just review that instead. So it's like, once this ends, I have something else in its place that I can review. And then that, you know, the Cruiserweight Classic, that runs until September, which is when I'm planning to start another countdown. I'm going to time it with our 9-year anniversary episode, to end like on our 9-year anniversary episode in November. And ideas are welcome, by the way, for that countdown. Nothing has been decided yet. So it's nice to see that as these things unfold and as these things end, and I have these other things, you know, planned to start, that this will keep us pretty busy through the fall, pretty much. Let's get to the mailbag. Get to your questions here. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I want to start here with an email I got from Jerry from Omaha. Jerry has written into the show before. He wrote in with a personal story, and I wanted to share it here on the show. He gave me permission to use it here. He says, about 6 months ago, I went back and listened to your podcast from August of 2010, right after the death of Lance McNaught, who wrestled as Lance Cade in WWE. You did a nice job dedicating a portion of your show to him. Lance grew up 2 blocks away from my house in Omaha, Nebraska. He was good friends with my older brother, RJ, and would always invite my brother and I over for pay-per-views. He was as passionate about the product then as anyone I've ever met, even at the age of 11. He became a pro wrestler because of his love of the sport. My favorite moment watching wrestling with Lance, very similar to your favorite moment, was watching the 1992 Royal Rumble at his house. I remember us going crazy with joy after Flair won that Rumble. Lance was a big fan of the Macho Man. The most upset I ever saw him was when the Ultimate Warrior beat him in that retirement match at WrestleMania 7. He beat the shit out of a pillow for a couple of moments after that match. Then he told us he was going to do an impression of his new favorite wrestler since Macho Man was out of the company. He picked up a cup, pretended it was an urn, and then nailed a perfect impression of Paul Bearer. It was downright hilarious. Lance stayed close to my brother when he got to WWE. My brother was able to see him at a show in Omaha. It was absolutely tragic what happened to him. Those memories of watching WWF with Lance will never be forgotten. So I just thought that was a really cool story that was worth sharing here on the show. Lance Cade is not somebody... he's not one of these guys who's passed away that you're going to really hear much about. You're not going to hear WWE probably talk about him at all. He wasn't a big, big star. But I think it's nice to just remember, you know, guys like this every now and then. And you know, hearing a story like that, it puts a human perspective on it. He's not just Lance Cade in WWE. You know, he was actually a human being. There was somebody behind that, and he was a wrestling fan since he was a kid. And it is a shame to see what happened to him. It's very sad. Felicity from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. What's your take on the video Vince Russo posted, then had taken down, admitting to going behind TNA's back to Destination America and Pop TV, even though he wasn't working for TNA at the time, to try to get a job as a consultant for their TV show? I think the fact that neither network hired him tells you all you need to know about how much help they thought he would be. I'm not shocked by any of this. And you know, to be fair, I saw a lot of stories saying Russo tried to sabotage TNA. Russo tells story of TNA sabotage. I don't think he was trying to sabotage them. He wanted a job. He wanted a paycheck. And they wouldn't give it to him. And why would they? Why would they? The guy spent, you know, off and on, mostly on, what, a decade working for TNA? And he was so well-liked, his last run with them, he had to be brought in, he had to be hired in secret. Imagine you work for a company for 10 years and left. And then in order to hire you back, they made an agreement with you that you can't tell another living soul about this. Nobody can know. The guy spent a decade working for this company. It's not as though he brought them to the promised land in those 10 years. Now he's going behind TNA's back to the heads of the network that they're on. He's lobbying for a job where he would critique their show. Oh, I'm sorry. He would make suggestions. He would make suggestions for their show. Why? Because Pop TV doesn't know shit about wrestling? That's their own damn fault. If they were stupid enough to make the deal and bring in TNA under false pretenses, okay, or their expectations were too high, that's their own damn fault. He's not some white knight riding in on a horse to save TNA. There is no white knight for them at this point. It's like, bro, TNA needs Vince Russo. Vince Russo does not need TNA. I could have come in, made Disco Inferno the champion. The ratings would have gone through the roof, bro. Through the roof, there wouldn't even be a roof anymore, bro. We'd have to bring in poles to hold the roof up until we could find a roofer to come in and fix it, bro. I never thought I would feel sympathy for TNA. It's like, just leave them alone. Just leave them alone. You know, it's like he comes off like a jilted ex-boyfriend or something. TNA broke up with him. They got into bed with someone else. The sex is still no good. Nothing has changed. But he knows what's good for her. And now he's calling her office. He's talking to her boss. Just give up the ghost, dude. They don't need you. They don't want you, and they don't need you. Ken Kemper. There are a lot of rumors about people in wrestling. However, there is one rumor I cannot figure out, like the one about Randy Savage. Now, he uses the word raping a 16-year-old Stephanie McMahon, which is rumored, he says, to be the reason Savage left WWE. Do you think anything actually happened? This question, I still get this question even after Savage is now in the Hall of Fame. It's been a few years now. Here's my take on this, okay? I think it's all just an urban legend that started somewhere along the way, whether it was started by a wrestler, or if it was started on an internet bulletin board back in the day or whatever. I think it's an urban legend. But the fact that Savage's own brother, okay, Lanny Poffo, when he gets asked about it, he can't say one way or another if it's true or not. And look, he's probably just being honest. He's like, you know, in his mind, I don't think it happened, but I can't tell you for sure. Randy would have to answer that, and he's not around to do that. But the fact that he wouldn't come out strongly against this and say, this is nonsense, this is bullshit, and blah, blah, blah. When I first heard his answer, like, well, I don't know, but, you know, you'd have to ask Randy about that. I was like, huh, that's an interesting answer. I can't tell you for sure that nothing happened. I can't sit here and say that. Stephanie has the power to put this shit to bed once and for all in the fall when her book comes out. She's got a book coming out. And nobody knows what's going to be in this book. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of fluff in the book and being a woman in the workplace and all that kind of stuff, and that's important. But this is one of those stories that she needs to address. And if nothing ever happened, if this really is all just bullshit and some rumor that was started a long time ago, she owes it to Randy Savage and his family to discredit the story, okay? Because the longer she goes without saying anything, all she's doing is she's fueling it. She's giving it credibility. But if he did do something, I could see her not wanting to say anything, because then it blows up into this mainstream media story that they absolutely do not want to have to deal with. Remember, when Randy Savage passed away, his death got a ton of news coverage. Vince McMahon himself, or somebody on Vince's behalf, I'm still not convinced that Vince himself wrote it, but People, I think it was People, right? People Magazine, they had Vince McMahon write a little piece about the Macho Man. When have they done that for anybody else? They didn't do that for Roddy Piper. And you could argue that Piper was a bigger mainstream star than Savage was, but Savage got a ton of mainstream publicity just for his death. Can you imagine if in her book, Stephanie McMahon admitted that Randy Savage, you know, sexually did something to her when she was 14 or 16 or something like that? Can you imagine the shitstorm that would create? And the headlines that the company would have to deal with? So, believe me, and that's the last headline you would want in the paper. So I understand if something, I mean, I don't think it did, but if something actually happened, I could see her not wanting to bring it up. But I really wish she would just address this and not profit off of it. And that's the other thing that bothers me, is that they know. They know about the rumors and they know about the story. They're not stupid. They're not oblivious to it. And when they did a Randy Savage DVD, they did the documentary on him a few years ago, they profited off of it. They tap danced around the story and they used it as a selling point to make money, because they addressed it, but they didn't. The best way I could put it. They kind of addressed it, but they didn't. So yeah, as long as there's money to be made off of it, I guess they're okay with it. But you know what? It bothers me that if this is all just bullshit, and I think it is, and nothing ever happened, you've got to just come clean and say it. And just call it what it is. Call it some silly nonsense rumors. She's got a book coming out this fall. We're gonna find out, I guess, at that point, whether she says something or not. But that's the forum to do it in, because if he didn't do anything like that, if all he did was make some comments years later, which I think may also be the source of where a lot of this heat comes from. It was like 2001 or something like that, and Savage did a video for his website at the time, and he was knocking Triple H, and he had some stuff to say about Stephanie, and I'm going to take your old woman and make a woman out of her, or something like that. You know, if that's really all it was, he doesn't deserve to be branded with this brush. Oh, you know, underage Stephanie. Like, him and his family don't deserve that. So if nothing happened here, she should come clean and just, in her book, just say that nothing happened. Mike from Los Angeles. Why do you think The Undertaker was kept out of the WWF title picture in the mid-90s? Except for his program with Yokozuna at the 94 Royal Rumble, I don't recall him having any other world title programs until WrestleMania 13. Taker was a pretty big babyface during that era, so I don't think WWF would have suffered any worse in the ratings or ticket sales with him as the champion. In fact, I think his feuds with Mankind and Diesel could have gone on to do better business. Instead, we got forgettable feuds with Mabel, Kamala, Giant Gonzalez, and King Kong Bundy. Well, those were all terrible feuds. I am not going to disagree with you on that. The matches were worse. But The Undertaker didn't need to have the title, and I think that probably is the biggest reason why. The Undertaker, pretty quickly after he debuted, even as a heel, he was over. I mean, people were into The Undertaker. He was a big star. People would cheer for him even before he turned babyface. He didn't need the title. That Undertaker character did not need to be the champion. So I think it was a combination of that, and a combination also of, look at all the names that you just mentioned. Mabel, Kamala, Giant Gonzalez, King Kong Bundy. These were all easy wins for The Undertaker. None of those guys were ever going to, like, in the end of the feud, come out on top and beat The Undertaker. So if you put The Undertaker in there with nothing but top guys, and you have him wrestling Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Diesel, and he's just wrestling those people, The Undertaker's going to have... It's almost like 50-50 booking, right? The Undertaker can't just beat those guys every time he wrestles them. He's going to have to lose. I don't think they wanted to beat The Undertaker very often. I think it would have killed some of the mystique of that character if early on in those kind of formative years of the character, he went out there and he had a 50-50 feud with someone. He had to go out there, he had to win. He had to beat people. He really didn't get beat very often, if you think about it. So you had to put him in there with guys that were an easy win, and I think that probably was the other part of it. These were easy wins. These were guys that the company could just bring in as you know, bodies for the Undertaker to knock down. And I think the combination of that and the fact that Undertaker didn't need a belt to be over, that's why you didn't see him as the champion very often. Ryan from Fort Worth, Texas. Have you ever seen Hulk Hogan take a backdrop? Other than the one Andre the Giant gave him at WrestleMania 3 when he reversed a pile driver attempt outside the ring, I personally have never seen him take or give one. Come to think of it, I don't think I have either. I thought this was a very interesting question to get from Ryan, because it made me think, and I, in my head, I'm trying to imagine Hulk Hogan taking a backdrop, and I don't, aside from WrestleMania 3, which was pathetic, by the way, the worst backdrop I think I have ever seen, and maybe that answers your question about why he never took them after that, because that one was so freaking horrible. I'm thinking he may have taken some of them when he first came in to WWF as a heel at the late 70s, early 80s. I would have to think he probably took some. You know, that before the whole Hulkamania thing took off. But I mean, now that you mentioned it, I can't remember him ever taking a back body drop. You know, even as Hollywood Hogan in WCW. I mean, at that point, he probably would have, you know, he would have crumbled into a pile of dust. So he should not. He probably should not have been taking a back body drop. That might have been the reason why he didn't take them. Flair took them all the time. I mean, Flair probably took back body drops in his sleep. You know, he people sleepwalk. He sleep wrestled. He was taking back body drops in the middle of the night. He took them so often. But yeah, I don't remember Hogan ever taking them, and I don't remember Hogan giving them either. So you know, somebody needs to find me video of this if it did happen, because I would like to see it. Henny from England. What do you think about The Rock going into the 2017 Hall of Fame in Orlando? His movie slate suggests that he is not going to wrestle again. It's his home state. And unless they go back to Miami anytime soon, there does not seem to be a better place for it. Also, who do you think should be the one to induct him? Who says he can't go into the Hall of Fame next year and still come back and wrestle? It's happened before. Piper, right? Piper went into the Hall of Fame in 2005. He came back and wrestled. A lot of guys have. I put it this way. I don't think The Rock has, for a second, I don't believe The Rock has wrestled his last match. He may well wrestle next year in Orlando. The only reason they couldn't do it this year was because of his movie schedule. If he can clear his schedule, he might have a match next year in Orlando. You don't know. And as far as the Hall of Fame, I mean, they're going to need headliners. It's going to become, as time goes on, you know, harder and harder to find true headline acts for the Hall of Fame, like Goldberg, right? They seem to be at least on decent terms with Goldberg, and they you know, they Vince would allow 2K to make the deal for him for the video game, because you need, you know, that didn't happen without Vince's blessing, and it's not like Goldberg left on the best of terms. And you know, the rumors many years ago that Goldberg was being considered for the Hall of Fame when they had WrestleMania in Atlanta, and Triple H put the kibosh on it and said he doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. A lot has changed in the last few years, and to the point where I think Goldberg himself could be a Hall of Famer or a headliner in the Hall. Goldberg is absolutely going to go into the Hall of Fame, but I could even see him headlining at some point. There were people who said Sting's going in. He's not going to headline. They're going to find somebody else to headline. Sting is not a WWE guy. They'll never headline with Sting. And what happened? They headlined with Sting. So things have changed enough to where not only is it possible that Goldberg is going to go into the Hall of Fame and headline, he'll probably get another match, another run at some point. But they're going to need headliners. That's the point. And The Rock is the biggest headliner of all. The Rock still has not gone into the Hall of Fame, and he's going to go in. It's just a matter of when. Yeah, let him go in next year. It's up to him, really. I mean, it's up to him. He has to be free, and he has to want to do it. It's his choice. So if he wants to go in next year, believe you me, he's going to go in. Now, as far as who does the induction, to me, the answer is Steve Austin. You know, his three greatest rivals were Steve Austin, Triple H, and Mick Foley. And you really can't go in, you can't go wrong with any of those three. But to me, Austin is the one that he will forever be linked with. So it should be him. And here's the other reason why I would do that. If you have The Rock going into the Hall of Fame, and you have Stone Cold Steve Austin doing the induction, that means you get Rock and Stone Cold on the same stage together. You can promote this as Austin and Rock one more time. Austin and Rock reunited. It's a great. It's almost like a great selling point for the Hall of Fame show. Anytime you can get Austin and The Rock together in the ring or on stage or whatever, you know what? I would promote the entire event around that. So for that reason alone, I would pick Steve Austin. Oscar from Puerto Rico. I was a little kid at the time, and I didn't follow the product, so my question is, around what episode of Raw or SmackDown did Triple H debut The Game entrance song, and what were your thoughts when you first heard it? I'm almost positive that it was the very first Raw of 2001 when he debuted that song, which, and it would make sense because he used My Time at WrestleMania 2000, and by WrestleMania the following year, he had Lemmy and Motorhead performing the new song. So obviously it was somewhere in that 2000 to 2001 period that he debuted it. I'm almost positive it was that very first Raw show in 01. Because I remember that they promoted a WWE title match on that first Raw of the new year. It was Steve Austin challenging Kurt Angle for the championship. Kurt was the champ. Austin was getting a title shot, and I remember Triple H interfering. I guess he had been off TV for a few weeks. And I remember him costing Austin the title and standing over Austin's body on the announce table. I want to say it was the announce table. And I think that was when the song first played. I think that was the moment they played that song for the very first time. And my first thought was, what a goofy song. That was my first thought. Like, listen to the lyrics. It's like, I am the game and you don't want to play me. It sounds so stupid, right? The first time you hear that, it sounds ridiculous. I just thought it sounded so stupid. But now, I love the song. I think it's a great song. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of that song. Oh, God, who the hell sings it? It's a hip-hop song. I think it's hip-hop. It's got this one lyric that, like, every time I hear it, I laugh because it sounds so stupid. I'm going to try to sing it now. It goes, this is so stupid. It's something like, something thirsty, and then there's a pause, and he just goes, because it was late night, and I was thirsty. Like, I don't know why. It sounds so stupid to me. I can't remember who sings it. But that's another song that I like. I actually like that song. But I hear that part, and it just sounds completely ridiculous to me. Nigel from Dallas. After watching Shawn Michaels versus Hulk Hogan at SummerSlam 2005 with Michaels hilariously selling Hogan's offense, can you discuss what was going on behind the scenes between the two of them? Well, I wasn't behind the scenes. I could tell you what the stories were at that time. And the story was that Shawn Michaels, in his mind, had an idea. And the idea was that he would win the first match. They would have a rematch at the following pay-per-view, which was supposed to be a steel cage match, and Hogan would get his win back. So they would trade wins. Shawn would win one, Hogan would win the other. Obviously, that's hilarious to think about, because Hulk Hogan had complete creative control over his character. Hulk Hogan would not even put over Randy Orton, who was the young star on the rise, okay, Bob Orton's son, wouldn't even put him over at SummerSlam the year after. Hogan did a lot of jobs in 02 when he first came back. I don't know if he just felt like, okay, I'm back. I'm kind of the new guy here. I have to, you know, show that I'm a team player, because he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. I mean, he won the belt, but then he lost it to The Undertaker. He tapped out to Kurt Angle. He lost to a bear hug to Brock Lesnar. I mean, Hogan deserves credit for putting a lot of people over and doing, you know, doing the J-O-B when he first came back. But now fast forward to 05. Hogan, you know, he's not doing too many jobs. He's got complete creative control. He's in there against one of the other biggest master manipulators, I think, in the history of that company. Maybe not so much in his second run, but certainly the stories are legendary about Shawn Michaels in his first run. And he flat out used to say, I won't lay down for anybody, right? That's what he used to say. Hulk Hogan now is supposed to put over Shawn Michaels. I could just imagine him thinking this in his head. He's like, no, brother, that's not what I'm doing. Hogan's idea was, no, I'll win the first match, and then I'll win the second match, too. That was his idea. How about we do that, brother? I'll win the first one, and I'll win the rematch, too. And Shawn wasn't very happy about that. And so what you saw there was Shawn basically saying, fuck it, this guy is a joke, his offense is a joke, and so I'm going to treat it as a joke. Now, I look at it, and it was very entertaining. I actually thought they had a good match. By Hogan standards, it was a hell of a lot better than I expected it to be. So I thought it was a good match. Did a lot of business. They did 500,000 buys for that SummerSlam on pay-per-view, which was a big number for SummerSlam. I mean, it wasn't like the, whatever it was, the 800,000 or 750,000 that SummerSlam did back in 98 when they were hot, but that's a pretty big number. And so Shawn oversold, and then of course he came out on TV the next night because the decision was made they're not going to do the rematch. Shawn is not jobbing to Hogan twice, so they just had the one match. It was one and done. Shawn came out the next night and acted like a dick in his promo. So we got to see a little bit of the old Shawn Michaels, or maybe not even the old Shawn, the real Shawn, right? We got to see some of the real Shawn Michaels bubble up there. But it was just funny, like, Hogan and Michaels, like, who's going to out-politic the other, right? Who's going to win out in the end? And in the end, it was the master. It was the Hulkster. He decided that, I'm not feeling it, brother. I'm not feeling it. Hulkamania is running a little too wild here. So that's what happened. We have two general manager buy or sells. So let's start with John here. John from California. Buy or sell. Mick Foley as WWF commissioner in 2000 or Stone Cold Steve Austin as co-GM of Raw in 2003? Between the two, who was more entertaining during their run? I got a buy on Mick Foley. Sell on Austin. That was when Austin was that the Sheriff Austin phase, right? That was when he was doing the whole Sheriff thing. He was coming out on the ATV. I thought that was a joke. I thought that it just turned the whole Stone Cold character into a joke, and I didn't like it at all. Not that he wasn't entertaining sometimes, but I just hated what he did to that character at that point. And Foley, especially his interactions with, like, Kurt Angle and Edge and Christian, and he had this, like, makeshift office in the back. I have a lot of fond memories of Foley as the commissioner in 2000. In 2000, you know, was just a great year for them. It was like everybody was just on point and entertaining in their own way, and they had a good thing going. So I got to buy on Foley and sell on Austin. Jason from Greensboro, buy or sell on the better general manager run? Stephanie as SmackDown GM or Eric Bischoff as the Raw GM? And this is a weird one. This is a weird one because SmackDown during that period was far superior to Raw. You will never convince me otherwise. You are, of course, entitled to your opinion. You're also entitled to be wrong. SmackDown was far superior to Raw. Period. End of story. And I was no fan of the whole, you know, Triple H... I hate even thinking about that whole, the dark days of Raw, but if we're talking just about the two characters, we're not talking so much about, like, the shows themselves, but, like, what they did, I gotta go with Eric Bischoff. I thought Eric Bischoff was a great Raw GM. I thought he was great. He's just a natural dick, and so I think in terms of playing that character on TV, he played it to a hilt. He was a natural at it. It just came across great. So I have to buy on Eric and sell on Stephanie. This week's sad tweet is more sad Twitter than any one tweet. I'm sure many of you by now are aware. Bobby Heenan was on Twitter. His wife Cynthia on her Twitter account confirmed it. And he got the blue check mark from Twitter to verify him. It was awesome. This is what people have been waiting for years. And I'm a huge Bobby Heenan mark. I'm like, this is so cool. This is awesome. And all the WWE people were following him. And, you know, like he praised Kevin Owens. And Kevin Owens responded. He was so excited. And I was skeptical at first, like a lot of people probably were. But, again, the Cynthia Heenan account has been set up for months. And I thought that was legit. Mick Foley came out and he literally said, hey, it's legit. Follow the brain. So it was like the greatest thing ever. And then it comes out that, in fact, Not only was the Bobby Heenan account a fraud, but so is his wife's Twitter account. The Cynthia Heenan account was a fake. And it's just so unbelievably pathetic to me that someone went through the trouble. Now think about this. Somebody had to go through the trouble of setting up a fake account for Bobby Heenan's wife. And he waited, or she waited, whoever it is, they waited months, because that account has been up for months, and there's been nothing about it aside from the fact that it wasn't verified, which apparently now we know means jack shit on Twitter. But she would just post, you know, very innocuous stuff. She would promote Bobby's appearances. You know, there were some legitimate people following her and interacting with her, and you wouldn't think that it was necessarily a fake account, because who would go through the trouble of faking it, you know, being someone's wife on Twitter for months? For months this person did this just to gain people's trust and set up an account for her husband. And that's what happened here. This was probably premeditated from the very beginning. And it's unbelievable that somebody would go through the trouble and the hassle of doing something like that. And that Twitter would so quickly verify that account without confirming the man's identity. Okay, that doesn't speak very well to Twitter's verification process, because there are certain steps you have to go through in order to be verified. How that happened, I have no idea. I mean, if you think about it, in a way, it's a form of identity theft. These people, these poor people, had their identity stolen. Somebody was acting on their behalf. They were masquerading around on social media as them, and people bought into it. People in the company bought into it. Friends of theirs bought into it. Whoever runs Harley Race's Twitter account, they bought into it. They were interacting with Bobby Heenan. The whole thing is a mess. The whole thing is sad, that anybody would do this to them. You know, it's so pathetic. It really is. The whole thing is just so pathetic. And Twitter also. Twitter ought to be ashamed that they allowed something like this to even happen. So that's this week's sad Twitter. But I don't want to end with that. I want to end with something positive. And so we're going to end on a happy note here. Let's end with happy tweet. It comes to us from @ChelseaHandler. This is what she said. Nancy Grace is leaving her HLN show. She says she wants to spend more time yelling at her family. Which, yes, I can believe. But that's the best news I've heard all week. Nancy Disgrace is finally off of television, or at least as of, I think, October, she will be off of television. And if you do not know who Nancy Disgrace is, you should consider yourself lucky. She is a vile, repulsive human being. She is one of the most really vile people in all of television, and that's saying a lot, because there's a lot of vile, repulsive people that work in television. So to be at or near the top of that list is no easy feat, believe you me. Go back in the archives and queue up Sound Off 323. Here is a woman who, like a day after the Ultimate Warrior died, was tripping over herself. She could not promote her show fast enough around the idea that rumors of illegal drugs and steroid use are swirling, which, whatever it was that caused the heart attack that killed the Warrior, and I have no doubt he juiced to the gills for many years, okay? At the time when he died, there were no such rumors swirling. Only in her empty head. And what I tell you, what really pissed me off about that was that list. Her producers had this list that they compiled of all the young wrestler deaths. And they included people in that list like Owen Hart, who fell from the ceiling and died in an accident. And they included somebody like Brian Hildebrand, who was a referee in WCW, who died of stomach cancer. Had nothing to do with steroids or illegal drugs or crack cocaine or anything like that. And they put them on that list. Their list of death. Like they were doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. Just everything about that woman and her show makes me want to take 5 showers. The Benoit stuff. When the Benoit stuff happened, you talk about disgusting. And it's not just wrestling, by the way. I mean, I'm talking about all these horrible wrestling stories. So you might say, well, of course, you're a wrestling fan. You're not happy about that. It's not just wrestling. She has exploited many, 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 many people on her show for ratings. So I'm getting all fired up now. It's all coming back to me. Go on YouTube, okay? Do yourself a favor. Go on YouTube and look for her interview. She did an interview with Elizabeth Smart. Elizabeth Smart was a young girl in her teens when she was kidnapped this many years ago. And thankfully, she was found. She was rescued, okay? Years later, Nancy Grace had her on her show. And she offended Elizabeth Smart so much. To her credit, the girl actually called her out on it on the show. It was an awkward moment, but it was so fucking cool. She called this woman out on her bullshit on her own show. Because she's one of these people, tell me about what happened to you. What did they do to you? And she uses this condescending, like, motherly voice. And she got called out on it. And I remember that. She's like, oh, okay, I'm so sorry. I just thought you wanted to come on and talk about, you know, help other people. And tell, like, shut the fuck up. Like, you got to find that interview and watch that. Her insane ramblings about marijuana. She tried to link it to murder. There was another video. This was after the Fukushima leak in Japan, okay, when they had the nuclear reactor meltdown and it was pumping radiation into the ocean. She got into an argument on her show with a meteorologist on the air because she was trying to scare people into thinking, oh, well, that radiation is going to wash up on the shores of California. And the guy was trying to tell her, Nancy, you're sounding the alarm bells here. It's not. Or at least it's not going to wash up on the shores of California like in such a way that it's going to be harmful to people. You're basically just scared. He was kind of laughing it off, but she helped because she knows better than him. Apparently, she's a scientist, too. She's not just a TV personality. And she's debating this meteorologist on whether or not this radiation is going to be harmful to people. And I guess it'll start killing people the minute it starts washing up. And the weather guy, again, called her out on her nonsense, but she would not budge. And you will find, if you go on YouTube, you'll find video after video after video of people calling her out on her bullshit. That's not the only time it's happened. It's actually happened quite a few times, and it's a lot of fun to watch when people do that. Just type in Nancy Grace owned into YouTube. I'm sure you'll come up with a ton of stupid shit that she has said over the years. So TV will be a little less filthy now that she's off the air. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. You can vote in our Raw poll, thumbs up, thumbs down, which goes up every Monday night after the show goes off the air. So definitely participate in our poll. Let me know what you think of the show. Don't forget, take advantage of the Pro Wrestling Tees sale. It's still going on until Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern is the cutoff. You got to use the code America at checkout to get 20% off all shirts in our store. And that is one way to support the show. You can make a PayPal donation, you can use our Audible link, or you could just spread the word and tell people that you know to check out the podcast if they've never heard it before. We will be back next weekend with episode 449. So until then, I want to say be well, stay safe, especially this weekend being the 4th of July and all. I think it applies this weekend especially, all the fireworks and such. If you blow all your fingers off, you can't tap the screen and press play on the podcast. That's really what I'm concerned about. So whatever you do, just make sure you stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next weekend. So until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
I'm just saying, I don't know, with New Day, you got three black guys out there. Why Francesca?
You want to call it Tyrone the Trombone?
Okay. That's racist.
Well, no, it's...
Racist, no.
I'm not racist. Go to Hulk Hogan for that. That's not me.
You know, usually the people that go, I'm not racist, yeah, right. Those are the racists.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.